Hello and welcome to Inside Right, episode 13. Today I am joined by one of my teachers at school, funny enough, but he's also an A-League referee, Matthew McCorrist. How are you?
Good, Wes. How are you, mate?
I'm good.
Great
long
to be
time
here.
No see.
Yeah.
So you're an A-League referee.
Yes.
I found that out a couple of months ago and I thought it was quite interesting.
Mm.
I was like, okay, I need to get you on as soon as possible. We've had Simon Wads on.
Yeah.
Now you've got a bit of competition to beat him. He's probably going to listen to this one, making sure that he still stays on top, but I think you've got him covered. So let's talk about your A-League refereeing career, but also how did you get into football?
So I was actually, I played football in for Barton Ridgebacks in the Sutherland Shire here when they first started. So in 1999, they actually started in Barton Ridge.
Oh, really?
And so played under sixes all the way up to 18s through Barton Ridge and had the opportunity to do that. Hit about 14, sort of thought, let's make a bit of money while we're trying to do it and that sort of stuff. So it was a good opportunity to do that. But
cool.
I've been involved in football for years through my old man.
Yep.
He reffed, played a range of different football over a lot of years. So I think it's been ingrained throughout my life that football was one of those things that we love to do.
Fair enough. Now, this is the make or break of the episode from here on. What team do you support?
In the country or out of the country?
Club football. Whatever. Whatever's your number one club, football, that's yours.
Look, my year 12 students definitely know that my favourite team is Chelsea. There's choices either way with that, but it's been something that my mates and I that have followed for such a long time that we love putting on the football and watching Chelsea match.
Do you have an A-League team? Well, you can't say that, can't you?
Not really, because we referee it. So
True. Tell me afterwards. I'm joking. Yeah, did you ever want to try and be a professional player? Did that ever cross your mind at all? Or
Look, there was opportunities to always do it. Like you always have aspirations as a young kid that you want to try and referee and play and hit those top levels. But I think I've sort of got to a point where I was about 16 or 17 and realised I'm not doing any professional football or I'm not running around like some of the others are with the top leagued clubs in, you know, NPL one. So I was like, I'm just out here for enjoyment at the moment.
Yeah, fair enough.
Yeah.
What got you into refereeing? What got you interested?
So I think what got me interested was the fact that Dad was refereeing in Sutherland Shire for many years.
Okay, gotcha.
And I still remember vividly down at Gomier Bay Road actually refereeing a line because we didn't have an assistant referee at that point in time for the match. Dad was in the middle. I was 13 or 14 and he's like, why not give it an opportunity? Come down, you know, while I was watching these games, jump on the line. All I want you to do is ball in and out.
Yeah.
And so just being on that match and actually being a part of it with Dad was an awesome thing that we got to do. It's something we get to share.
And you can bond over, right?
100%.
That's awesome. Awesome. So, Matthew, that feels weird saying your first name. You ref a couple. You ref A-League fixtures, right?
Mm.
How did you progress to that level? What's the process?
So the process to become an A-League official in Australia is about, obviously, you're starting off at grassroots level.
Yep.
So I started refereeing in about 2012, 2011 in Sutherland Shire for the Referees Association there.
Yep.
Did about 4 or 5 years with them. Still referee with them now, obviously, but four or 5 years. Got opportunity and selected through coaching and support people in that space actually move into progressing into State League.
Yep.
So at the time when I first moved from Sutherland to State League, there was an academy called RDP or Referees Development Panel. And so that was run by Football New South Wales. They then obviously had a select group of referees that would referee anything from 13s up to 16s and you just referee those matches from there.
Yeah, cool.
From that moves into the State League model.
Yep.
So the State League model covers NPL 1, 2, 3, State League 1 and State League 2.
Gotcha.
So they've rechanged that name. So it's NPL 1, League 1, League 2 and NPL obviously, 1, League 1, League 2. So they've changed the model and I think there's going to be more changes in names, but I think the name's staying the same.
Yep.
But the same premise follows. So, you know, 20s and first grades had the opportunity to do that.
Yep.
2011, 2012, from memory, was when I was involved in the youth league program.
Okay.
So that was where A-League clubs would have a youth league program, so their second or third tier team or the ones that are obviously buying for the spots for the A-Leagues.
Yep.
And we would go through and just referee and officiate that. So that would happen in the summer. We'd be involved in those sort of games and yeah, just was lucky enough to be appointed to two grand finals to then have the selection process to A-Leagues.
I find that so interesting how the competition is for refereeing, because you can only get the right decision or try your best, right? So there must be extra pressure to even just try and get picked for something like that.
Well, it's a funnel. So if I said that there's, say, 100 positions and for the top tier in the country, and you already know that the FIFAs are going to be holding, say, 30, you know, 10 or 12 of those positions, then you've got a select group underneath of male and female officials. The funnel gets tighter the further you get up.
Okay.
So
interesting.
It's a select group in the same way not everyone's going to have the opportunity to walk into an A-League team.
Yeah.
And have that same category. So there's obviously processes that go behind it.
Nice, interesting. Can you remember any challenging moments whilst you're refereeing? Any challenging experiences that come to mind?
I think the most challenging experience I found was when I was 14 years old. I was refereeing at the Ridge.
Yeah.
And we just had a coach who didn't necessarily like any of the decisions. This is an under-10s match. And
you're 14.
And I'm 14.
Yeah.
And so I'm out there obviously officiating the match, the best that I know, go through, everything's there. No matter what I could do, I was just copying abuse. Came off at halftime and obviously Dad was supporting at that time down there. I went, I don't want to go back on. This is crap. I'm over it. I don't want to be here. And he said, no, go back out. These are the processes that you need to do. You know, step through the process. If this happens again, this is the action you take. This is what you need to do, and you reprimand in that process.
Yeah, wow.
Went back out the second half. Had an awesome opportunity to be able to go through and referee it. Similar decisions happened. Walked over politely and said, this needs to stop now. If you do this again, I'll be removing you from the field. Obviously did it again. Said to the player or the coach, sorry, you need to leave the field. He goes, I refuse. No problems. Banned in the match. Walked off.
Wow.
So I was in tears at halftime, didn't want anything to do with it, obviously had some very, very difficult things to be able to do, and for a 14-year-old to come back in that space and actually want to go to that next
step
was hard. And I think that obviously was the make or break moment for me to go, okay, this is where we can actually have that experience.
That just developed a path for you, which, that's a big moment.
And it's hard.
That's awesome.
Because refereeing itself can be a very difficult thing because you're managing players while having to draw a very, very objective and subjective situation with decisions too.
Yeah.
So it's as much as it's like, here you go, this is the decision, let's move on. It's also we need to be able to engage with people in that same process too.
100%. What kind of I'm really interested by this actually. What kind of preparation goes into officiating a match for yourself?
So if I was to talk about what I would normally do.
Yep.
So if I'm at an A-League match, we get appointments about 2 weeks out from a match. So the second that I get to the appointment, it goes in the calendar, I start to log, okay, what do I need to do?
Yep.
Food, nutrition, everything starts again, not like it changes anyway, but it's about keeping that strict regimen and that plan of process.
Yep.
So it starts from there, then we get to about a week before. So a week before we train twice a week and then obviously from there we do a normal session and then a match reduction.
Yep.
So if I've got a Saturday game, for example, training's on Thursday, we'll then do a match day minus two. So a match day time minus two session obviously leads into that match.
Okay.
So the physical preparation is in the same circumstance.
Yeah.
About 4 or 5 days prior to a match, I'll actually sit online and do a simulator. So a simulator as an assistant referee is just onside, offside decisions where you can sort of just check whether a player is onside or offside by clicking.
It's like a driver's test, but for refereeing.
Yeah. And so it's a practice thing that I use to mentally prepare for the match.
Yep.
Then obviously you turn up to the game on the day. So the day before, prep starts. So if it's a 7 o'clock kickoff, prep starts from 9 a.m.
Yep.
9 a.m., wake up, normal, good breakfast, bit of recovery, mosey around the house, that sort of stuff. We need to be at fields about 2 to 3 hours before kickoff.
Yep.
So allow travel in that situation. Mm-hmm. So in Sydney, we'll travel anywhere from Newcastle out to Bathurst, as far west as Penrith, and then obviously Allianz out at Sydney FC.
Yep.
So the travel arrangements are obviously a little bit different depending on what needs to happen. Arrive 2 hours before, check in with the players, check in with the clubs, obviously make sure the officials have arrived.
Mm-hmm.
Then once we then check in with that, check the field, make sure it's all okay, functional, check all our gear, make sure that's all fine. Then obviously warm-ups, game, and then post-game recovery and other things like that happen as well. So
I just want to talk more about the mentally sharp part of refereeing and preparing for a game. Because obviously, I know this for a fact, referees cop abuse, right? No matter what league you're in, no matter what game you're officiating.
Mm.
When you hear stuff being like, shout at you, abuse, how do you just stay in the game? Because sometimes, surely, it must be hard to stay in the game. So how is there any tips you'd take to try and keep in the game zone?
I think, like, in the same situation, if you talk to players, players will go, when I'm concentrating and focusing on match decisions and what's happening,
yep,
my concentration is on the match, on the players, where mm-hmm. I need to move, how I need to move the ball,
yep,
where I go. As an official, obviously, we don't have the ball. We're not playing the game. We're officiating, yep, it. So our preparation is obviously our focus points. So as an assistant referee, my focus points, second last defender, but also trying to make sure I look up the field to assist the referee with, yep, decisions that have to happen.
Yep.
Yes, there's going to be abuse that's going to happen. It could be at a local match where you're doing 10 kids, or it could be at an international fixture where you've got hundreds of thousands, if not 10,000s plus, obviously, online viewership. Mm. So in my circumstance, personally, we're all mic'd up most of the time with comms. Yep. That blocks out half of the comms.
Okay.
The other half is focus points on what's sitting in front of me. So, yeah, there could be noise. I might hear it, but you try and zone it out because, yep, you're listening for kick points. You're listening for those sort of things, even if it's loud as anything.
Mm.
You still need to be able to listen. And so it takes a lot of an ability to be able to switch off the noise that's around you,
yeah,
which sometimes can feel white noise-like because there's always noise in the background. So it's, yep, just a really good thing that you can sometimes go, I need to focus on this, okay, point. This is how I do that.
Okay.
So it could be as simple as tricks or triggers and things, mm, like that, or, you know, mental calls that have to happen in your head.
Yeah.
But it just depends on what you're doing at that time, and it's all different to each official and what's happening.
Interesting. So now a question quite similar, well, under the same umbrella.
Mm.
How do you handle the pressure under making split-second decisions?
So if I'm talking from an A-League match,
yep,
A-League match, the process for me as an assistant referee, so say it's an offside decision.
Yep.
So the process is it offside, is it not? If the, yep, answer is yes, yep, then you will more than likely say offside, it's in your head. So, yep, you'll call the offside in your head first.
Yep.
Now, the next phase we have to do with VAR implementation, yes, which we will talk about later, yep, on, is a delay protocol.
Yep.
So we'll then obviously call delay. We need to delay the decision.
Yep.
And so that allows the attacking phase or the APP to occur.
To proceed. Yep.
When that goes through and then the attacking phase is finished, we then come back and then the offside decision's there. So, yep, if I think it's clearly offside, I'll call offside. If it's not an attacking phase, flag goes up.
Okay.
Now, if it's a flash lag, so flash lag is basically when two players are on offside and it's very tight.
Okay.
Sometimes, yeah, 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 you always want to give the advantage to the attack. Yep. Sometimes it's clear as day and you can see it.
Okay.
So it's about making the decision really quickly and taking that mental snapshot.
Okay.
When you take that mental snapshot, then you give yourself that extra time to make the decision if, okay, you have to,
yeah,
because,
yeah,
there's always this ideal sometimes that when you make a decision, you've got to make it that instant second,
yeah,
and it has to happen. Sometimes, and I got taught very early on, that you've got time to make that decision, and sometimes it can be as good as taking that extra couple of seconds or two, which will feel like an eternity,
mm-hmm,
but it helps you make the right decision at, yep, the end of the day,
okay,
which is so helpful.
Because sometimes you do see, you know, very tight calls, but they let the game keep playing,
mm,
and I'm not sure if that's got to do with VAR, just saying, wait, but you would have taken that mental picture in your head, thought something, but you've kept the game going just in case it may be slightly correct, because we're talking millimetres here sometimes, mm, right? Yeah, so I find that really interesting.
Yeah.
Now, let's get straight into VAR. How's the introduction of VAR impacted your role as a referee? Do you feel less pressure to get the right or wrong call, or is there more pressure because people will look at your ability as a referee and go, oh, okay, we look back at it now, it's the wrong call? Or do you see it as the other way around, like, if I get the wrong call, it's absolutely fine?
I think in the situation, so when VAR was first implemented, it was the first year that I was on the panel.
Okay.
So refereeing football prior to that wasn't necessarily done for me in the, mm, same capacity with the amount of cameras and the technology and that sort of stuff that was,
yep,
involved. So,
yep,
I only ever know football through VAR.
Yeah, okay.
So for me, I find it sometimes a little bit more daunting because you have to rethink sometimes the decisions, and you have to go, well, not rethink, that's the wrong term. Sometimes you've got to be able to make the decision.
Yeah, okay.
And then realize, okay, what's the protocol?
Yep.
So as I said before, if it's an offside thing and we know it's clearly offside, but it's an attacking phase, mm-hmm. but you could have got it wrong, you need to be able to go, okay, yes, it's offside. I think it's offside. I'm going to delay this so that the VAR can be implemented. If it's a goal and then my decision's incorrect,
yeah,
then VAR can come in and save the day.
Instead, yeah.
So, again, and that's really hard from a spectator's perspective too, to try and be aware of that, because spectators going, it's clear as day, why can't you just stick the flag up and say it's offside? Yeah. Or why have we got to wait this extra time?
Yeah.
And a lot of it will come down to if we're making decisions and we're not 100% right, or we're, you know, not saying that we're guessing in that situation, but it's not overly clear,
concrete, right?
100%. Yeah. It's removing the error that can occur.
Yeah, the gray area, yeah, yeah.
But at the end of the day, VAR is not AI sitting somewhere. It's still a person sitting in the box, two or three people plus VMOs and other things like that, so video match officials who are watching the match.
So video match officials, is that like the assistants to the VAR?
So in the VAR, if you've ever seen them pan to VAR.
I've seen box, like a little box in the corner.
So you'll see a number of people in there.
Yeah.
So you'll see the VAR themselves.
Yep.
So Australia's most renowned VAR is Chris Griffiths-Jones. We see him on a number of matches hitting, you know, 400 to 500 matches. So very, very experienced in the A-League.
Yep.
Then sitting next to that person, you'll have a AVAR. So they're an assistant VAR, and they go through and they'll analyse things that are happening. So if there's a check that's occurring, the AVAR will then obviously watch what's happening. Mm-hmm. So if something happens while there's a check occurring, then that obviously goes through that process.
Yeah.
Then you'll have a person who's a technician who will then help cut footage, move it backwards and forwards and things like that.
Yep.
And then they'll have coaches and other things in there providing feedback in the same situation that happens too.
Interesting. Now, the big question, and this is just your opinion, all right? Do you think VAR has overall improved the fairness of the game, or do you think it's kind of, I don't want to say ruined because that's not the right term, but do you think it's a lot harder to watch games and go, oh my God, it's this goal, because we've got to wait, we've got to harness our excitement? What do you think of VAR?
Well, let's flick pass it back. As a purist in football, what's your thoughts around what you think
my
about
thoughts?
It? Yeah.
Okay. So I loved football growing up. The first team I watched was the 2013-14 Liverpool team. We almost won the Premier League. The season Stevie G slipped over, Suarez, Sturridge, Coutinho, they're the players I love.
Mm.
And since then I've watched football my whole life and absolutely loved it. And now what I don't like is it could be Man City 2, Liverpool 2 with a minute to go, and Mo Salah could be threaded a ball through to him, he scores. I just can't celebrate. Now, some people still go off their heads, but for me personally, I find that really hard to celebrate, because I know if I do go crazy and it's offside, I just feel it tears your emotions. So yeah, I'm not the biggest fan of it, but that's why I wanted to get you on to learn more about it and to make my mind a bit more at ease.
So yeah, I look at it from a point of view as we want referees in a lot of the perspectives, because we take a lot of time where we go through and analyze games, taking hundreds of hours, if not tens of thousands of hours of football. Yeah. We analyze it. We make sure we're getting right decisions and that sort of stuff. So you build that efficacy of approach of how you want to be able to make sure that you're officiating a game.
Yeah.
For me, if I make an error, and that error is affecting someone's ability to be able to make, for example, you know, there could be financial things, there could be something for a selection process, there's other things like that, I would prefer someone to go, nah, look, the decision's not right, we need to fix this up.
Yeah.
Rather than obviously get the error wrong, then come back and say, well, you stuffed it up, and we go, well, okay, true. We unfortunately don't have recourse.
Yeah.
So I see both sides of it. I totally get the spectator appeal of, well, we wanted to get it right. We wanted to be able to celebrate at the point in time. But if it's clearly wrong, like there's a handball in the penalty area, there's a trip that's not seen, there's an offside that's led to a goal, and that affects the clubs and the players and the way things happening in the future and that spectator appeal, that's where I go personally. VAR definitely helps in that situation for us.
Yeah, true.
And it, and in a lot of the circumstances you've seen slowly, especially if you look at Women's World Cup, the way that FIFA and IFAB have moved towards letting spectators know.
Yeah.
Like if we look at NFL, in an NFL game when there's a decision made, they come over live comms and that sort of stuff and discuss
basketball
that thing.
Too. Yeah.
Basketball's the same thing.
Yeah.
So the Women's World Cup was the first opportunity we had to actually communicate this to the general public.
Yeah.
And the fans, from all the stuff we've looked at and I personally looked at, took it along.
It's rather positive.
Well, we now know what's happening. We're not left in the dark. There's not this hidden situation of, well, what's happening in the circumstance. So
Okay.
I think that's been a positive step in the right direction in how I feel that that's moved.
Yeah.
But a purist will go, no, it's either right or wrong. At the end of the day, if it's wrong, then we move on. But
Let's talk about red cards because that's more subjective, right? That's really off what the ref's decision. He looks at the monitor. And it's either, does he think it's a red card or not? But there's been so many times where I feel like VARs really influence the ref to give a red card. What do you think about that? Because personally, I think I love VAR in the sense that on an offside, you know, it's either right or wrong, like you just said. Now, as long as I find it a bit annoying at the time, but I understand why we have it and it's the correct decision and all that. But red cards, sometimes I feel like VAR shouldn't be involved and they should just keep to the ref's decision. Sometimes I think that. What do you think about red cards?
All right. So the first thing that's probably want to clarify is that the referee is still the sole decision maker with regards to VAR.
Yeah. Okay.
So the on-field referee, if there's a, so say for example, there's a penalty, something happens, there's a red card and it's been completely missed.
Yeah, okay.
The VAR can then come in and say, hey, referee, this is the VAR. I'd like to recommend an on-field review for a potential dog-so red card situation. Can you come over to the screen? That's when you obviously then see the referees will give the screen signal, come over to the screen.
Yeah.
Now, that's if you're in the box, for example, as the VAR, you've made a decision as a referee because you're still an active referee.
Yep.
I think that this is a red card. This is my considerations.
Yep, go and check.
So we then go through as in the VAR, check the considerations in that situation. So is it clearly wrong? Is it denying an obvious goal scoring opportunity? Other things like that.
Yep.
So there's about three or 400 different considerations that you have to go through in any range of decision making for referees.
Okay.
When they go through and then check that, the referee then go, yes, no, maybe, okay, can you show me another angle? No, okay, I think this is a red card. I'm going to go back out and issue a red card in this situation.
Yep.
Referees can also turn around and say, no, I'm not coming across to the screen, thanks.
Really?
But that's
a communication thing. I did not know that.
But that could be career suicide. Imagine if you're in a match in that situation and a VAR's come over and said, I recommend an on-field review, and you go, nah, we're fine. I'm right. I smashed it. Sometimes that can actually have an impact.
Yeah.
Okay. And I've seen overseas in that sort of stuff where some things like that may happen where it will where that can potentially occur.
Yeah.
But 9 out of 10 times you'll find a referee will come over, check the decision, have an opportunity to review it, and they might go, yep, I agree, or no, I don't agree, these are my considerations, and then come over and upheld the previous decision.
Yep.
So it's an interesting one because if we look at it, if you look at it from a spectator point of view, spectators are like, well, it's the VAR sitting, you know, in the booth making the decisions. If we look at NRL, it would very similarly follow that process where it's, well, the referee is still the sole decision maker in that situation.
Yeah.
And that's helpful to know so that then we can obviously look at it from a different perspective
that's
too.
That's great to know because I feel like a lot of people feel like the on-pitch referee doesn't really have as much power as he used to.
Yeah.
But I that's when I think there needs to be a bit of communication between the spectators and that. Because like you just said, good example is, I saw it. I don't think it's a red card. I'm not. I think we need to hear a bit of that as well.
Yeah.
However, there's also the other argument where if you did that in the Premier League, there could be riots at stadiums. So I can imagine that as well.
Yeah.
Going.
It's still communication as well though.
Yeah.
And that's where I think the step forward, which took a long time, like we've had VAR for what, 6 or 7 seasons in Australia at the moment.
Yeah, probably.
EPL probably another 1 or 2 years behind that, if not a half a season, if so, behind. So Australia was one of the leaders for VAR in the national league in the world.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of other leagues that are now slowly coming onto it and using that sort of stuff. So you could say in some situations we were the test test people actually going through and setting up that process. But it all takes time. Like, you can't ever get a perfect product out in that situation. And sometimes that takes time to be able to do it and then for the spectators to take on board. Like, we go back 6 or 7 years ago, VR was seen as this worst thing in the world because they're like, well, this is taking away from the game.
It's stopping the game.
Now it's expected. Yeah. Players expect it. Fans expect it. And if the decision's wrong, they're like, well, hold on. Why didn't they recheck that decision?
Yeah, okay.
So
yeah, true. Do you think it's in – I know it is, but do you think it's a problem that it's stopping the game flow?
I don't think so.
Okay.
Because if there's a decision that happens on the field, say, for example, that there's a challenge that's borderline yellow card or red card, it's clearly wrong, a check will occur while the match is still playing.
Okay, yeah.
And so from that point of view, there's always silent checks that sometimes will still go on in the background. Those silent checks are then done to be able to then go through and do that. Okay. So if there's a check that's done in the background, like, nah, you stuffed it.
Yeah.
There's a really wrong decision. That's then obviously where the game will then stop and the referee will then come over and check the screen and check that sort of stuff.
Interesting.
But there'll be always checks that go on that sort of stuff and done behind the scenes.
Nice. Because I was speaking to my dad last night and I said, I'm getting a referee on tomorrow. He's like, right, I got some questions for this guy then. So overall, we're happy with VAR. Is that what we're saying? Happy
I think we're in the right step at the moment. Look, nothing's ever perfect. Yep. If I say refereeing in anywhere perspective, doesn't matter what code was perfect, we would never have any open to interpretation decisions.
Exactly.
And so this is just another tool that we use as officials to make the game better, to allow us to make the right decisions and inevitably, you know, add to that extra theatre that we want to do because our main job is to not sit there and be the grumpy ones making the wrong decisions. We want to facilitate entertaining football.
Yep.
And sometimes that means that we've got to let things go a little bit. There's going to be little knocks and bumps that happen.
Yep.
And so by us doing that, then that allows the game to flow. Spectators obviously like to see that, a little bit of that sort of stuff. So,
Cool. How do you effectively communicate decisions to players and coaches during a game? We've talked about the technology side of things. Let's talk about the people playing and involved in the match.
Yeah, it depends on the person.
Okay, and we're not using names.
No, definitely not. We know for a fact that there's definitely coaches and players that walk out onto the field. They must be maybe the greatest person when it comes to off the field, but on the field there's this different persona that comes through.
Yep.
So I think in our perspective, we as the referee team will normally discuss how we're going to communicate.
Yeah.
Now that not only talks about communicating to each other, but that also talks about how we're going to communicate in the particular circumstances.
Mm.
Like I wouldn't say we go and say, well, this target player is going to be an issue. We're going to go ahead and do that. But we're going to go, hey, sometimes this player will come along and have a conversation about decisions. This is how I'm going to approach it. Or can you let me know if I'm getting involved too much in conversations and I need to sort of move on?
Okay.
Most of the time it'll be, this is the decision, this is the reason why. 9 out of 10 times you'd say a player's going to be okay with it. Mm-hmm. If it's something that's a complete honker that they don't agree with and they want to have an argument,
crazy.
That's where we go, okay, well, we're not going to discuss this now. We need to do this. This is a decision. And unless my referee team is coming in and say, no, you stuffed it, we need to move on. And it's hard because it's a theatre as well.
Yeah.
Like, You look at it, coaches have a massive passion for that. Spectators have a massive passion for the game.
Yep.
And they want to be able to see that. And sometimes that adds to the theatre. But in the circumstances, if the theatre becomes too much and we see it's affecting, you know, the match and how it's carrying on, we go, well, let's hold it back a sec.
Yep.
We need to actually be able to do that. So there's different management strategies. You might go, nope, sorry, I'm not discussing this. And some referees will just walk away.
Yeah.
You know, if we look at some of the World Cup referees that we've had recently that come through either in the Women's World Cup or the Men's World Cup, most of the time English is maybe a first language or a second language. So it's a lot of non-verbal communication through the use of cards, through the use of hand gestures, nose, things like that.
Yeah.
So it depends on the person. Each referee, in the same way that each person has a different way of communicating, it's all going to be different.
Yeah.
Some players you'll turn around and, no, get lost, stop being a Muppet.
Yep.
Some are like, no, you've got to have a conversation and go, nah, he actually got in. This is the reason why. And they go, sure, no problems, and they move on.
Yep.
Some you can't communicate to at all, and so you go to the captain. He needs to go. Like, get him out of here, otherwise we're going to have to take further action. So.
Okay, interesting. Because in rugby union, only the captains can speak to the ref.
Yeah.
I think they should install that into football or soccer.
Look, it did definitely help. I think it
definitely should,
because it removes that aspect of it, and it stops the crowding of referees. It's like
14 players 100%. Going over to the referee. 100% agree with that.
But it's a cultural thing too.
Mm.
If we say, for example, we changed it in Australia and were to come through and do that, will other leagues around the world follow through? Maybe, maybe not. It's all going to be relative and depending on what's happened too. So,
what's the most memorable match you've officiated so far, and why?
So I think the most memorable match I officiated was the first match that I refereed with.
Yep.
I was with a Sydney-based team, so Kurt Ames, Steve Lucas at Sydney FC. First match I refereed, loved walking out into the theatre, just having the crowds that we did pre-COVID, walking out to this atmosphere and taking it all in.
Yep.
Just was surreal. Mm. Nothing can ever prepare you for a match like that.
Okay.
And then you go out to it and the pace is nothing in comparison to what you've prepped for. You think you're fit. Yeah, no.
the amount of
effort that's required to necessarily keep up with the players in that situation. And some of them are professional and semi-professional. They're training twice a day, 100%. Up to six times a week throughout the different loads. So it's important for us to keep up with our training and match the players' speed and their agility, their movement and that sort of stuff. But, you know, That was the most memorable match, I think, for me so far. Probably the next one I would probably say was the highest one was my 50th match. Again, New South Wales team refereeing in Sydney, reaching 50 matches and actually having that supporting situation was awesome.
Yeah.
That obviously was the year after Usain Bolt was in the country when he was refereeing and playing for Central Coast
Mariners, right? Yeah, yeah.
So that was an awesome opportunity to have that and actually officiate one of the matches that he was in. He was down there and that sort of stuff. So
imagine being the linesman for Usain Bolt. That's hilarious.
But you find sprinters are quick. I wouldn't necessarily say they're quick out of the blocks because there's a lot of things. Usain's a tall bloke. Most of the speed's not in that first 10 or 20 metres.
No.
It's after you get in that distance.
Right? Yeah.
And so that's really difficult sometimes to be able to move it. So if we look biomechanically, footballers are going to be normally really quick, short, sharp movements and that sort of stuff. Whereas the long-term high intense speed doesn't necessarily happen in football.
True. Yeah. So interesting. Very, very interesting. This just popped into my head.
Yeah.
Stop clocks in football instead of stoppage time, we put a stop clock. When is the decision? Obviously, when a ball goes out for a throw and we don't stop that. But when is the decision? Red card, offsides, goals scored, celebrations. Should we stop the clock?
So I'll think of an example that I had. So I was at a MacArthur game last season in Campbelltown.
Yep.
Was the longest football match ever played. 3 hours and 59 minutes from start to finish.
And it wasn't even a final.
And it wasn't stop clock. Wasn't a final. It was because of the weather. So it was when we had the storms and that sort of stuff come through. We're on, we're off, and then we're back on in that situation.
Have been a
nightmare.
We put it
out. Oh. So if I think about it from an athlete's point of view, when we're performing in that situation or where that sort of stuff, or we're, you know, being involved in the game, we have to set ourselves up, warm up, prep, cool down, warm up, prep, cool down. Yep. Do that a couple of times. If you did it over a stop clock, you're probably moving a game that would be a 90-minute match. Plus injury time and that sort of stuff, closer to two and a bit hours, depending on what happens.
Yeah, okay.
The reason I use that as an example is in futsal, when you get to international futsal, it's stop clock.
Okay.
So when I used to referee at the same time I was doing youth league, I ref futsal at the same time in Australia.
Oh, okay.
So futsal was stop clock at an NPL level and in the F League, so the National Football League in that situation. Anytime the ball goes out or there's a stoppage in play, clock stops and that sort of stuff, but it's only a 40-minute half. So a game only going for an hour and a half.
Okay.
So if we did it for football, I think we're going to run into those situations too where we run that circumstance of too much time. So there's things that we put in place. So if there's a throw-in that's taking too long, we chat to the ref players, let's hurry up and that sort of things. Yep. Obviously the most evident is when a goalkeeper's taking their sweet time.
I can't stand it.
And the caution comes out in that situation. Most of the time you want to try and manage it as well.
Yeah.
As if we're running around and you're going every time it hits 6 seconds, bang, there's a caution for delaying the restart. We don't have no goalkeepers.
And slowing the game. Yeah.
So it's a fine balance between, hey, we need to to speed up the match, let's do this. So you'll use your communication tools of, hey, let's talk to the captain, let's get the game going and that sort of thing, all the way to, okay, you've done this two or three times, there's a consequence for the actions, we'd need to set this up differently. So stop clocking football would be awesome, but we're going to have matches that will go for 4 hours.
Yeah, okay.
So true. That's my thoughts on it anyway.
Fair enough. I'm not sure if you can answer this. If not, totally fine. Are there any specific players or teams that stand out to you in terms of sportsmanship? If you can't say any names, no problem. We'll move on to the next.
Well, I think if we go across the board, any teams that we've refereed, lot of them always want to be able to come out and do the best.
Yeah, okay.
You know that passion's going to be involved.
Of course.
You know that sometimes it's all going to be people in that situation. Like we could work anywhere.
Yep.
If we think of it as of an employment, some people we work, we don't want to be with. Some people we go to other people we don't want to be with, and they're not necessarily easy to work with. Some are awesome and you want them to be their mates and they're lifelong colleagues and friends and stuff like that that you know.
Yeah.
Wouldn't say that there's any one particular team or club or anything like that, because most of the time we need to be there as part of the match to help facilitate it. We need them as the players and the clubs and the league as much as they need us to be able to facilitate matches. So it's a unison that we want to try and work together in that circumstance.
Great answer without giving any examples. Fantastic. What advice do you have for any individuals who aspire to become a referee? Because obviously your dad was an inspiration for you. Is there any advice he gave you which you've taken on but also tweaked? And if anyone came to you and said, I want to be a referee, what advice would you give to them?
So if I had someone who said, I want to be a referee tomorrow, what do I do?
Yeah.
I would automatically go, I'd love you to do a refs course, come and do this for certificate, set up, move into that space and go through and do that. The next step is then obviously realize that you're going to be one of 22 plus obviously spectators and that sort of stuff. So sometimes you've got to make the hard decisions. But through experience, through watching football, through understanding it, even if we call it smelling the game. So you have that sixth sense of smelling the game. You can sort of know when things are going to be tense.
Yeah.
Sometimes you're going to make the wrong decision. But the wrong decision is not going to define you.
Yeah.
Because if it defines you, and again, referees, and I know for me personally, but I can say this for all other referees, we're perfectionists. We want to get the decision right 100% of the time. We're never wrong. We want to make sure we do that because that's just the nature of what that is.
Yeah.
But we're not always perfect. Cool. So realize that if you're a younger referee or you're moving into that space, you're not going to get perfect.
Yeah.
But be confident in that situation. Yeah. Okay, I may have got it wrong. I want to try and improve for that for next time.
Yeah.
You know, if we look at, there's a decision that I remember looking at this season, I think we'll ask, month or two, where the referee got hit, the ball changed and it went up the other end and the ball went in the back of the net.
Yeah.
Remember when they had 22 players? Yeah. Same situation. It's really hard. Hit the referee and it's a move on situation. What do you do?
Right.
So the next circumstance, that referee, I can tell you now, they're not going to be standing there anymore when that happens. They will reshift their position to do that. So you'll find some officials will actually chat to clubs and chat to players and teams and go, if I'm in this position when you're coming in, am I in the wrong spot?
Yeah.
And so sometimes you'll see an official will move depending on where that is so that things like that don't happen. So advice is just take on board everything that's around you.
And if a problem happens, do your best to try and learn from your mistakes.
Yeah.
Yeah, cool. How can aspiring referees best prepare themselves for challenges of officiating?
I think it's by, for me, it was by doing heaps of matches.
It comes with experience.
Doing
those simulation things.
You can do simulation. I can play as much FIFA as I want. I'm still not going to be an esports athlete. Yeah. I can tell you that straight away.
Michael Oliver, Premier League referee.
Yeah. So it's never going to happen. But I think from my perspective, it was about understanding what was in the football, actually refereeing matches, making the wrong decisions, but then not getting to a stage where I'm like, I know better. I'm done.
Yep.
It's okay, how can I improve? And even now, I've got coaches who will sit there and sometimes, you know, will always give you feedback and things to improve on. If you take everything on board and you then obviously make small changes, it may not be straight away, it may be something later on. Those small changes are definitely going to help with the longer term picture of how to improve.
Yeah.
And if you walk in that situation, you're expecting to be the best referee without any effort off the back of it.
No way.
Not a chance.
Yeah, not a chance.
You need to, it takes time. You know, if we talk about elite athletes, you know, you pick your top 10 elite athletes around the world. They had talent, but talent also came with hard work.
Yes.
And if you don't mix those two together, which can sometimes be seen as a different thing for officials, some of us, there's a perception sometimes, officials just turn up, we just referee a match and go home.
Yeah.
There's so much prep that happens in the same situations on the back end that we need to be able to do to actually get to that level and do so.
Interesting. Well, I've got a game. All right. Red card, yellow card. In this instance, however, you want the yellow card.
Right.
Yellow card is a good thing. It means you got it correct. And red, obviously, you don't have to leave, but you got it wrong.
Okay.
Now, before I mention that, do you remember, might have been a year ago now, there was a La Liga match and there was a white card given out. Do you remember that?
I remember hearing about it. I didn't see it. Discipline
or something.
Yeah.
Do you guys talk about that or is that a interesting fun fact rule that you guys learn? Or
look, I saw it. It must have been something that was done for that particular league.
Okay.
I know that FIFA a few years ago brought in a thing called FIFA Fair Play.
Yeah.
And so FIFA Fair Play would be an opportunity where if someone's done something in an awesome situation where it's positive for that individual, they would then obviously issue the card.
Yeah.
So if I'm correct, and happy for you to correct me, hockey has a green card.
I don't know anything about hockey, so we'll take your word for it.
I know that there's another sport, and I think it's hockey, and so they actually have a green card for fair play or sportsmanship.
Yep.
And so that is a great opportunity to do it. My thoughts, if we're rocking up and you pull out a green card, a player's going to think it's a yellow or red card.
Yep.
So it's really hard from that perspective to potentially go through and do it. But there's always scope for it. It just depends on how it's sold.
So if you had four yellow cards and you got a white card, should that eliminate all your yellow cards?
No.
No, okay.
So, if you're still making decisions and you're making errors, there's...
Yeah, fair enough. All right, so you got five trivia questions, and if it's a yellow card, you're correct. If it's a red card, unfortunately, you're incorrect.
This could be difficult.
Who is the only Australian referee in the Premier League?
Currently?
Yeah, currently.
Jared Gillett.
Correct. What nationality is Fulham attacker Adama Traore?
So if I'm Traore, it's not Portuguese, it's Spanish, I think.
Correct.
Yeah.
Well done. We talked about this before.
That's okay. This is easy,
easy correct one. Who are the two big? Who are the two teams being added to the A-League?
So Canberra United.
Yep.
And Auckland
Knights.
I knew it was Auckland, but I couldn't remember the Knights.
There you go. So it'll be 12-team competition, I think. No, 14.
Yes, eventually moving to 14.
My goal this season's, because obviously I've just always European Premier League, so my goal this season, and I've spoken to guests previously, is to get more invested into the Australian game because it's something I need to do and it's something I'm guilty of not knowing a lot about. So this season, I'm not going to the Sydney Derby, but whoever wins that will be my team. So there you go. What number does goalkeeper Edison wear for Manchester City? If you get this right.
Look, it's a different... I'm going to say it's number one, but I don't think it's correct.
It's 31, so
it's
a red card. And last question before we wrap up. How old is Ange Postecoglou?
I can't say he's 60 yet.
Do you want a clue? He is older than Jurgen Klopp.
That's not really helpful, is it?
Well, I'm sorry. Well, there you go.
Look, if I wanted to pick a number and based on when he used to play, I'd say have to be mid to late 50s.
Okay.
If I'm going to pick a number, 57.
It's 58. You're close, though. I think that's 3 out of 5.
Yeah.
Take that.
That's not too bad.
I've learned a lot today. Thank you very much, sir.
See you tomorrow
for class. And, thank you very much for joining me on Inside Right today.
Thanks, Wes. Appreciate it. Thanks for your time.